I don't know how to use overheads. I was thinking about an alternate title for this talk might be Fourier Integral Operators for Dummies. And then I realized it was more properly by dummies than for dummies, with apologies to my co-author, Michael Amro. But so I decided to stick with this title instead. And you can see right off the bat, I have an opportunity for an inverse problem here. In fact, I do have an inverse problem. So let me just quickly calculate the pseudo. I'll turn this into a matrix and do a pseudo, a singular value decomposition of it here. Okay, I got that. Now let me throw away the smallest singular values, and now let me invert it. Okay, and we'll get the approximate inverse. There we go. Oh! Well, you can see it's close to the right answer, but... I minimized some kind of norm there, but I'm not sure which one. So, levity aside, I'm going to talk about some Fourier integral wave field extrapolators that have actually been used in geophysics since, to my knowledge, since 1980, although we didn't realize they were Fourier integral operators until just the more recent last few years. And I'll start out with sort of a review of stationary wave field extrapolators and show you how they're derived. And one of my points to this talk is I want to show you my way of deriving a Fourier integral operator from the wave equation, which is maybe a little different than it normally happens. And it relies on what I call the nth derivative approximation, and you probably would just call a hunch. I'll use that to sum a Taylor series, and talk about. Then I'll give you a sort of a panorama of examples. Finally, and show you that these wave field extrapolators actually work. So I want to focus on a basic problem that can be considered to be sort of a single atom in a seismic imaging scheme, and that's what I call the wave field extrapolation problem, and. Unlike most of the speakers here, my X and Z's are just scalars. So this is just a two-dimensional wave equation, which I've just written down for... everything here can be generalized to 3D quite easily. The wave field extrapolation problem, as is useful in seismic imaging, is quite simply... If you know a wave field at a level, say, Z equals zero, and you wish to compute what that wave field... might have been at some depth beneath your receiver, Z equals delta Z, and let's assume that the velocity structure between zero and delta Z depends only on the transverse coordinate, the coordinate transverse to the direction of extrapolation. So how can we solve that problem? Given a wave field here, how can we extrapolate that wave field a distance delta Z? So given psi at z equals zero, let's get psi at z equals delta z. And it turns out you probably realize that that's actually an ill-posed problem, because I really would need to know both the wave field and its first derivative in order to d by dz of the wave field in order to solve that problem unambiguously. So it's standard to assume that to deal with that ill-posed problem by assuming what we call one-way wave propagation. And in the geophysical literature, we would assume that we're dealing with waves that are moving only up from a scatterer down at some depth in the subsurface. So let me make a few definitions, and again, apologies to those who like their Fourier transforms to wear hats. Mine don't wear hats, they simply change symbol. So if big psi is the wave field of x, z, and t, little psi is the monochromatic or temporal Fourier transform of big psi, and then phi is the spatial Fourier transform over the lateral coordinate of little psi. So phi is a 2D spatial temporal Fourier transform of big psi. So how do we solve this problem in the constant velocity case? Well, this solution is in many textbooks and been known for a number of years. You can write it this way, that again, assuming one-way waves, that given the wave field up here, we can Fourier transform it, and then use that wave field in a Fourier operation. And this is purely an inverse Fourier transform. Here's the wave field spectrum being multiplied by an operator, which in this case is just a filter, just an ordinary spatial filter. So this is what I would call a stationary operation, and we're simply doing an inverse Fourier transform. Now, what about some Fourier integral operators that are generalizations of that? Well, here's one of them, and this one was, to my knowledge, was working. There was a working code at Chevron. I used to work there in 1980 that used this, essentially this equation, although we didn't know how to write it down this way, for 3D seismic imaging. In 1984, it was published by a couple of geophysicists, again, not in this form. 1985, Fishman and McCoy had published a very nice mathematical physics paper in which this is one of their approximate solutions for factorizing the Helmholtz equation, although, again, the connection to geophysics wasn't explicitly stated there. And then later in the 90s, there are a number of algorithms called phase screen and pseudoscreen algorithms. People like Ruxian Wu and Martin DeHoop have been investigating those. So this, in fact, could be considered a generalized phase screen extrapolator. But the key difference between this and the stationary extrapolator is the fact that this V, which was a constant in the previous case, has now become a function of position. So we have an inverse Fourier-like integral, but instead of having an ordinary filter, we have a pseudo-differential operator symbol that depends on both x and kx. Now, there's an alternate extrapolator that we've been working with, and it turns out that this one is explicitly, as I've written it here, is just the transpose of the previous one, but you can also consider it if alpha were purely real, which it isn't, this would be the adjoint form. So I call this an adjoint form pseudo-differential operator. But let me explain what we're looking at here. Instead of an inverse Fourier transform, we're looking at sort of a generalized forward Fourier transform. Here's the wave field at the upper datum. We're calculating the spectrum of the wave field at delta z, as opposed to the standard pseudo-differential operator where we had spectrum here, we're getting wave field here. Now we have wave field here, we're getting spectrum there. We have the same wave field extrapolator, the exact same pseudo-differential operator symbol, except we're integrating over x now, whereas in the previous case we're integrating over kx. You can show that this is, in fact, if alpha were real, this is the adjoint of the previous operator. Since alpha here is complex, it's the transpose. So, so how might this operator have been? How was the Fourier, the stationary operator derived? Well, one of the nicest ways to derive it is a Taylor series argument, which I attribute to Birkhout, though I think it's probably earlier in the mathematical literature elsewhere. So I just want to show you the Taylor series argument that you can use to derive the stationary wave field extrapolator, and then I'll show you how you might morph that into a derivation of these Fourier integral operators, and then move into some examples. So how might you derive the stationary extrapolator via a Taylor series argument? Well, you simply start out and you Fourier transform the wave equation over both t and x. Now here, velocity is explicitly a constant, so we're just doing classical PDEs. So we have a Fourier transformed wave equation over all variables except z, and then we construct a Taylor series and simply say that the wave field at delta z is the wave field at zero plus all of these infinitely many derivatives at zero. And how do we get those derivatives? Well, we assume that we have only upward traveling waves so that we know how to take the square root of the previous equation. And taking that square root, we can say that d by dz of the wave field is simply ikz, and kz was square root of omega squared over v squared minus kx squared. So now I can compute the nth z derivative by simply taking powers of IKZ and stick that in the Taylor series. And again, in the constant velocity case, we get all z derivatives exactly. So I can complete the Taylor series by summing it. And I get the wave field extrapolator, which is, again, a phase shift operator that is an exact solution for one-way waves. Of course, if you've got two-way waves and you have enough information, you simply get another of these operators with a minus sign here. So now I will show you a way that you can morph that argument into something that's approximately true for the lateral velocity variable case, laterally variable velocity case, and show you how these two different Fourier integral operators can be seen to arise from it. And I'll try to be explicit about where the key hunch is in this argument. So I'll begin with the Helmholtz equation. And now, instead of v being a constant, we've got v is an arbitrary function of x. So what can we do here? Well, let's just Fourier transform that equation over x. And you have to integrate by parts twice and throw away a couple of boundary terms, but eventually you can get to this expression, which is an exact prescription for the second z derivative, and it looks like an adjoint form, what I call an adjoint form pseudo-differential operator. So again, you've got wave field in, spectrum out, and it's an exact prescription for the second z derivative. And kz squared is omega squared over v squared minus kx squared. Now, we can play this game a little differently. We can return to the Helmholtz equation and simply stick in, on the right-hand side, stick in psi as an inverse Fourier transform of its spectrum. And then move the operator inside the Fourier integral, play the standard pseudo-differential operator game, and we'll derive a pseudo-differential operator, not the adjoint form, but the standard form, pseudo-differential operator for the second z derivative. So here we've got spectrum in, wave field out, as in a standard pseudo-differential operator. So I've derived two alternate forms for the second z derivative, both of which are in fact mathematically identical. And of course, that's just saying that d squared by dz squared is self-adjoint. This inspires me, at least, to make a key hunch in this Taylor series argument. But before I get to that, let me just give you a little state space interpretation of these operators. So here I've got an initial state, and the final state being the state with the second z derivative having been calculated. And here's the x omega domain, and here's kx omega domain. So what's that operator doing? Well, it's calculating the second z derivative by, it's allowing us to calculate it by this path. We're moving from the initial state to the final state simultaneously with this change in domain. And then I've left implicit the inverse Fourier transform of this quantity, which gets us back to the desired final state. And again, this is what I call an adjoint form pseudo-differential operator. Now, what about the other form? Well, it goes this way. So we take a forward Fourier transform, staying in the initial state, and then move from the initial state to the final state via this more complicated Fourier integral or pseudo-differential operator. And that's a standard form. So we have two exact expressions from the wave equation for the second z derivative. What might we do to apply this Taylor series argument? Well, the temptation is to replace the two with an n, and then come up with two approximate forms, alternate forms, for an nth derivative. And so I'm motivated, at least, to consider two approximate ways of calculating an nth wave field derivative in a case of laterally variable velocity. and one which is an adjoint form pseudo-differential operator, the other is a standard form. And the little plus sign is just indicating, plus or minus is the direction of Fourier transformation. So what can I say about these operators? Well, first of all, they're exact for the second derivative, no matter what V of X is, and approximate for all other orders. However, for constant velocity, both these forms are equivalent and exact for all orders. So that suggests there might be a realm in which there are good approximations for the problem I'm trying to solve. So how can we... I should have mentioned this acronym. It's just an acronym for the standard form Fourier integral operator. It stands for phase shift plus interpolation. So I'm simply going to apply this Taylor series argument now and assume that I can calculate the nth z derivative in the way using those operators and show you that we can in fact sum this series and get that Fourier integral operator. So I'll replace the z derivatives now with this approximation dj minus. And so I've written the Taylor series in the spatial domain, replaced that all nth derivatives with these approximate operators. And move the... So here's the expression for the operators. Then I'll interchange the order of integration and summation. And you can see here that an exponential is about to appear. That's the series expansion of an exponential. And in fact, so what we're going to end up here with is the generalized Fourier integral operator, where we have, I would call this a standard form, where we have a spectrum in, a wave field out, and we're applying a non-stationary wave field extrapolator, which is the same one I had defined previously. Now, what about the alternate approach? Where this is a geophysics acronym, non-stationary phase shift. To get here, we start with the Taylor series in the Fourier domain rather than in spatial domain, and we use the other class of operators. Proceed in a similar fashion, using the D plus operators this time, and one can derive this Fourier integral operator again with some. It's difficult to quantify this hunch that I've made in this derivation, but I'll get to that in a minute. So what have I got now? I've got two wave field extrapolators that I can contrast in this state space again. One extrapolator that involves a Fourier transform from spatial domain to wave number domain, and then a Fourier integral operator back to the extrapolated state. And then the other one involves a Fourier integral operator from the initial state to the extrapolated state, and then an inverse Fourier transform. Now, of course, you can represent either of these as singular integrals if you wish, and create the singular integral realization of either of these, and that's what you in fact want to do if you want to realize that they are the adjoints or transposes of each other. So both of these are Fourier integral operators, and I mentioned that they are transposes of each other. If you use this operator to go down and you take the adjoint of that operator, you get this operator going up. Both operators handle strong velocity gradients and anisotropy, and in my panorama of examples, I'll give you evidence of that. What does this derivation do? Well, for me at least, it makes it clear where the key hunch is. And that is that the key hunch is that we can approximate these derivatives in this way. So how good an approximation is that? Well, we've just sort of made some initial inroads at assessing this approximation. But one thing you can do is use the composition theorem for pseudo-differential operators. And that's kind of tempting, because if... take D1 plus, for example. I said it's an approximate first derivative. So, yet I have an exact form for a second derivative. So, perhaps I can use the composition theorem for pseudo-differential operators to derive the symbol for D1 plus applied twice and compare it to the exact result. So, if you do this, which I will not... do the calculation for, but I'll just show you the result. If you apply D1 plus twice, you can calculate the symbol, and I've called it gamma z. If you apply D1 minus twice, you get gamma z star, and star is complex conjugate, and gamma is this thing. So everything... Oops. There we go. So... the symbol has a leading kz squared, which is the desired term, and everything else it represents, I guess, error terms. And if you look at d1 minus, you see that, in fact, the error series is just the conjugate of d1 plus, which suggests that if we use these operators in some kind of an alternate leapfrogging scheme, perhaps first this one, then that one, we might get a better approximation, because we see that these error terms tend to oppose each other. And that does seem to be the case. So this suggests, although I don't think it proves, because I've only analyzed the D1 operator applied twice, this suggests that the first order errors in one operator tend to oppose those in the other operator. And that perhaps if we have an algorithm that combines both of these, we might, in a symmetric form, we might get a more accurate result. And that suggests, at least to me, it suggests using a Weyl form pseudo-differential operator rather than a Cohen-Nirenberg. And these suggestions are supported by numerical experimentation, which I'll be showing you here just in a moment. Yeah, here we go. So here's the first example. Suppose we have a wave field a medium which has a discontinuity in it. On the left-hand side we have v 1500 meters per second. On the right-hand side we have v of 2500 meters per second. And let there be a source here and receivers there. And the source is 200 meters below the receivers, and we want to explode that source and propagate the wave field up to the receivers. Now, it turns out you can actually solve that problem exactly with an eigenmatrix approach. And this is as exact a solution as I know how to compute. And it would only be approximate in the sense that we've discretized to make this calculation. So the source was down here somewhere. What you see here is upward propagating wave, a transmitted wave. The interface was here. There's a little head wave here, and there's a reflection from the source. So you see a rather complex behavior. So this isn't using either of those Fourier integral operators. This is instead an exact solution that's kind of laborious to compute.
Is this a 200-meter depth step?
Yeah. That's a large step. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah,
That's a big step, yeah. So suppose I take either of those Fourier integral operators and take the same 200-meter depth step, what do I get? Well, the standard form Fourier integral operator actually has a discontinuity in the wave field at the place where the symbol was discontinuous. The adjoint form doesn't. In fact, it has a single, what appears to be a diffraction, but that diffraction is characteristic entirely of the velocity field, the slower velocity, which was on the left of the discontinuity. So if I'd had two sources, one on the left and one on the right, you'd see two diffractions over here, one characterized by the faster velocity and one by the slower velocity. So, and over here you see a single diffraction, but it's discontinuous, and the slope over here is characteristic of V2, the faster velocity, and the slope over here is characteristic of V1. So, they're both wrong, but I know they're wrong, and for one thing, I took a far greater extrapolation step than I might normally take. So now let me take a bunch of small steps instead of a big step. So 20 10-meter steps, the Fourier integral operator, the standard form, it begins to look a lot like the exact result. And the adjoint form, again, it begins to look a lot like the exact result. In fact, they're very similar. And there's the exact result, just repeated twice. So if I just go back and forth, you can see there are subtle differences, but they're very close, which is a strong indication that these results are asymptotically correct as the step size shrinks to zero. Here's another example. Again, I think I've switched the where high and low velocities are. Yeah, high is on the left now and low is on the right. And now instead of having one source, I've got a bunch of scatterers, so the diffraction response is upside down from what it was before. But again, this is the standard form Fourier integral operator. So in the presence of a velocity discontinuity, you see we again have this discontinuous discontinuity induced in the wave field, but we get roughly correct behavior on either side of the discontinuity. Whereas the adjoint form has no discontinuity, but in fact there's also no refraction in energy as it crosses the velocity boundary. And again, roughly correct behavior as we move away. And if one were to simply take the average of those two operators, which appears to be a very good thing to do, in fact, you start to get results that look quite like what we expect. Now, here's a more complicated example, and this is an image created from what's called the Marmoussi model, and this is finite difference data created, though, back in maybe 15 years ago by a French institute, and it's been used for many years to test migration algorithms. And what you can see here I've got depth, here I've got distance. This is a highly heterogeneous model, Every black line you see here represents a reflector, and between every black and gray line, you've got a velocity change. So you've got velocity changes everywhere, and you've got some major faults in this thing. And here's the target down here beneath all the complicated structure. And this is quite a good image, in fact, and it's done with the standard form pseudo-differential operator. Or Fourier integral operator. I would call your attention to these blobs up here. And if I use the adjoint form operator, you'll notice that those blobs are going to change sign, roughly. There's the standard form. There's the adjoint form. So the average tends to get a more acceptable result with less computational artifacts, fewer computational artifacts. Here's another interesting example that I've concocted purely to characterize how these operators behave. I've got three possible velocity scenarios over here on the right, either constant or a lens, or in fact random velocity variation. And for lack of time, I'm not going to show you the lens. I'll just show you constant and random. My input wave field is just going to be a set of impulses, and we're going to extrapolate those impulses first 50 meters up, and then we'll go 50 meters back down again. And the idea is to look at how well these wave field operators can invert each other. So to get an idea of what we might expect to see, let me do the constant velocity case, which is exact. So I take those eight impulses, and I step up 50 meters in with a constant velocity exact operator. And the wave fields look like this. It's a superposition of a bunch of hyperbolas. They're all asymptotic to velocity v equals whatever the constant velocity was. The Fourier transform, the two-dimensional Fourier transform of that looks like this, and you see that we have a bunch of discrete lines that correspond to the positions that are induced by the regularity and position of my scatterers. And this triangular shaped region is in fact caused by the fact that wave numbers out here are evanescent and don't propagate. So if we now take that result and inverse, we take this result and extrapolate it back down, we might expect to recover the initial eight dots. We don't. We recover little crisscrosses at each of the eight dots, and the reason being that we haven't attempted to invert the evanescent portion of the spectrum. We've just used the adjoint operator instead of the true inverse. And this is standard. This is the way it's done in geophysics. We don't use the true inverse. We don't attempt to recover exponentially damped wave field components. So this is really the best we can do. And you can see that we've got well-resolved spectral lines, and we've got nice little crisscrosses here. So now let me go to the random velocity scenario. Let me take a step up with the NSPS Fourier integral operator, which is the adjoint form. So you see what I've got here now is sort of eight roughly hyperbolic things, but they all have different times at their crests, and they all have different shapes. And over here in the Fourier domain, I've completely lost resolution of the spectral lines. So, and that's just saying, if you think of it in terms of plane waves, what it's saying is that my plane waves don't propagate and remain planar as they propagate. In fact, they mix. So now suppose I try to invert that, step back down with the same operator. I get a mess. So I step up with the adjoint form pseudo-differential operator, and I try to step back down with the same adjoint form pseudo-differential operator with just a change in sign in the exponent, and it's not a good inverse. However, if I step down with the standard form pseudo-differential operator, it actually is a pretty good inverse. And bear in mind, this is a really rigorous, this is a difficult test for any wave field extrapolator because the velocity medium is random. So you can see I've got clusterings, focusings here, and there's some indication that I'm resolving spectral lines over here. I'll just show you the alternate scenario where I step up with the standard form adjoint pseudo-differential operator. Again, in the presence of random media, I get a nightmare. But the amazing thing is that stepping down with the adjoint form will invert that quite well. So here's stepping down with the standard form. Not a good inverse, but stepping down with the adjoint form is quite a good inverse. So these two operators are really sort of yin and yang of each other, or hand and glove, and they are very useful in extrapolation scenarios. And I'll just show you a couple of adaptations of them. One is that you can adapt them to handle topographic settings. And so how do you do that? This is another in my endless litany of hunches. Well, how do you do that? Well, you can take the delta Z step, the step you're taking down, and simply make that a function of position. So imagine we have data gathered on a topographic surface. This might be the reflector we're trying to image. And color is indicating velocity here. So what would seismic data look like gathered along this topographic surface in this case? Well, this is a finite difference simulation. So this ugly-looking event here is actually the normal incidence reflection from that convex anticline. So if we simply use one of these Fourier integral operators and we take a downward step that now depends on x, which really isn't computationally any more difficult. Show you a bunch of results there, just depending on how many downward steps I take. And I've shown you here's the known shape of this anticline. So we've got, not only have we got topography here, but you can see that color indicates velocity. So we've got velocity gradients as well. Of course, not a real surprise that the best result is with the most number of steps and the smaller step size. But any of them are actually pretty good. Now, we can also adapt these operators to handle anisotropy. And again, a hunch, but it works. The hunch is make velocity depend not just on x, but on wave number. And then you have to develop a map between your anisotropic model of wave propagation and which typically specifies phase velocities as a function of angle, and you have to develop a map between angle and wave number. But that's not difficult to do. This is what we call physical model data. So unlike the previous results, which were finite difference models, this is actually real wave field data. At the University of Calgary, we've got this physical modeling tank, and what we do is we create models out of resins and epoxies and that sort of thing. And this model, in fact, was about, say, yay big. And what it consists of is an upper medium that is very anisotropic. It's made from a bunch of canvas sheets that are laminated together with some kind of a resin. And the grain in the sheets is dipping roughly at 45 degrees here. And then beneath it we have a target, which is intended to represent a reef, and it just has a step. There's just a step function in the reef. So the challenge is to image this reef at the right position in the presence of an anisotropic overburden. So this is what we would call tilted TTI, transverse anisotropy. So the axis of symmetry is tilted at 45 degrees. So if you develop a map between wave number and direction of propagation, you can construct this wave field extrapolator. First off, I'll just show you what you get if you don't do that. Here's the here's an isotropic migration where we've ignored the anisotropic overburden, and you can see that we image, while the image may look like it's coherent, it is in fact in the wrong position. And the anisotropic migration done with hunch number 27 there images things quite well. Here's a more severe case. This is both anisotropic and heterogeneous. Again, this was done with physical modeling. So we have a modeled thrust sheet, which again is built of a layered canvas material and phenolic resins. And here are the anisotropic parameters, fast and slow velocities. And this is meant to indicate, to be prototypical of situations encountered in mountainous areas. So down below the thrust sheet, we've got an aluminum plate. So this plate should image as flat. The thrust sheet should image as it looks. And everything's embedded in an isotropic background. So the thrust sheet itself is highly anisotropic and heterogeneous. This is just a single source record from a collection of several hundred over that model. And here's the result of migrating that single source record. All of these migrations I've shown you have been essentially conducted this way, but I haven't shown you any other source records. So if you take all source records and you stack them, here's the result of using these Fourier integral operators, the final anisotropic heterogeneous migration. You can see the top of the thrust sheets image very well, and we can also start to make out these joins. And we've done an excellent job of imaging this basement reflector as flat, which it should be, whereas an isotropic result, they're essentially the same at the top of the thrust sheet, but everywhere else they're different. So I'll just flash back and forth. So you can see with the Fourier integral operator, we're handling both heterogeneity and anisotropy in a way that is able to unravel our physical model data. So just a few conclusions. I've shown you a couple of Fourier wavefield extrapolators that their origins are kind of rooted in the lore of geophysics, but I've shown you a way to think about them from a Taylor series approach. And I'd love it if someone can give me a more rigorous way to derive either of them. The key approximation in what I've presented is this hunch that we can approximate the nth order derivatives by a particular pseudo-differential operator. And of course we sum them and get Fourier integral operators. These two algorithms that I showed you the operators for seem to have first-order error terms that oppose one another, so they seem to work nicely in a combined scheme. And in fact, all the images I've shown you use them in a combined scheme. And then I showed you this panorama of imaging results that looks very promising. And thanks to everybody that's paying for this. Thank you.
Any questions? Comments?
Well, maybe I can make some remarks. You're talking about the mass community will know this, but the geophysics community may not know it. Instead of the Taylor series approach, in fact, there's a whole school of people that apply same group theory to PDEs. And in fact, you're looking at a throttle product. And so all of that is known in the applied math literature. In fact, a lot of it is known in terms of those propagators even that you talk about. Now, one word of caution, you're propagator is, as you wrote it down, not a Fourier integral operator. In fact, you need to introduce a cutoff function exactly where your kx is equal to, what is it, all of all vx. Otherwise, the phase function is not non-degenerate. And in fact, that corresponds to physically with turning rays. And that is exactly the nightmare of those one-way theories, is that if you have, say, a solid overhang and you want to backpropagate, you like to have a mechanism to turn those rays.
Yeah.
So well, the standard Fourier integral operators, in this picture, you could not do that. So they're not Fourier integral operators as you wrote them down.
Well, we have looked at how to handle that evanescent boundary, and typically the way we've done it is to extend the operators across that boundary in a way that we ensure that they're exponentially damped. So you can, in fact, extend the symbol in a way that as you go from the region where the square root is real to where it's imaginary, that you make sure that everything is exponentially damped. Now, I know that doesn't handle turning waves, but it does seem to stabilize the operators themselves. But anyway, your comment is understood.
And then there's one other thing that's nice you can do when you do apply the theory of Fourier integral operators to your propagator. I mean, you mentioned in the beginning you're interested in strong gradient and apply it there. Now, in fact, your step size that you played with, you can give an upper bound of that step size in terms of the lateral derivative, in fact, the C1 norm, of your medium fluctuations by applying the clean intersection calculus by composing two of those propagators, two steps. And what it tells you, you can find a very interesting bound in the vertical step in terms of the horizontal gradient. And what that basically guarantees is that you would not lose, say, caustics. If you have caustics propagating and you want to work with a finite propagation step size, how do you know a priori that you do not lose any part of the wavefront set of your propagator?
Yeah.
And so you can derive that. And that is where that's actually a very nice analytic tool rather than playing around with large or small step sizes. You just go like an epsilon below that estimate, and you make it variable, and that is how you can most efficiently propagate your waves. But then, of course, you have to subject it to a cutoff. You cannot do the turning ray case in that situation, but you really need other kind of operators to deal with.
Yeah, we've looked at similar things, although not in such a fancy way as you describe it there, but we can, in fact, just look at phase errors as a function of depth, step size, and lateral gradient, and you can attempt to, in a simpler way, and I'll follow up on your suggestion, but you can attempt to link depth step with allowable depth step size with lateral gradient just by looking at phase errors through ray tracing.
You can do this analytically. That's a nice part. In a closed form expression, you just compute the C1 norm
in
the lateral direction of the velocity, and you have an estimate, so you don't have to do
That's good.
Which is a nice one. Maybe another good reason for applied mathematicians to work on, for example, seismic imaging in this case. Good day.
Thanks.
Thank you, Martin.
Yeah. There is an exact solution for what you know, I have seen there. Because the eigenmatrix, this is what the modal expansion, or is it technique by Greenberg? I don't know.
I don't know who it's originally due to. We just developed it ourselves, and Paul Binding has also provided us with an exact solution. But in the eigenmatrix case, you can develop it for basically arbitrary V of X. You don't just have to have the two discontinuous blocks as I showed them there.
Okay, and why don't you use that exact solution always? Is it too expensive?
Too expensive.
I think there is a paper in Geophysics by Greenberg and someone else from Delft where...
Our eigenmatrix expression is quite similar to theirs, although they end up essentially using a finite difference approximation at some point in addition to their matrix decomposition, and we've avoided that. So for a little slight technical wrinkle, I think this eigenmatrix approach is a little better, but it's still very slow.
There is a package at Rice University called ArcPath, based on Arnoldi techniques, Arnoldi, I remember, which is quite fast, and you can select a set of eigenvalues. Something like that might help you speak up.
I don't know about that. But maybe I can get some more information.
You're practicing MATLAB, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very slow for
Any other comments or questions?
Sorry?
ArcPath is built in MATLAB, I think. Or
it's Fortran, I think.
Right. Yeah, but it's also been incorporated into MATLAB.
Oh, okay. I didn't know.
RPAC? Is that?
Arnoldi package.
Okay. Any other comments or suggestions? Questions? I think it's again the speaker. We convene in 15 minutes, 20 to 12. Thank you very much.